Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 6th of August. A delight to have you here and to have you with us. I very much look forward to having you discussing the subjects of the day with this incredible panel. I will introduce them to you in mere moments. I also welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to have you share your thoughts with us as well, and I say that now. Okay, it's 15 minutes past 9 o'clock on the 6th of August. Let's get started. We welcome Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. It's I'm doing well. I'll note sort of as a grim reminder, today is actually Hiroshima Day, and we should all reflect on both the World War II, what the country was fighting for, but also our innate ability to be brutal to each other. So it's a grim but important day, and I think as we talk about the current world and the current conditions and sort of where we are in the geopolitical situations, that we should remember the suffering in the past.
And realize of we've been there before, but we could certainly be there again.
Very much so. And sometimes I think we're too glib with comments like I'm going to move two nuclear subs to threaten Russia.
Right.
And we forget that there are real world implications that could affect us all.
Bob, starting off with a skip and a step this morning. We go to, but I thank you,
Mr.
For your
Optimism
comments.
Again.
Yes, I thank you for your comments. Fred Hoff is with us, diplomat in residence at Bard College. Ambassador, how are you?
I'm doing well, Joe. Delighted to be here, and thanks to Bob for a reminder of what happened 80 years ago today. I think it remains something that's extraordinarily relevant.
I have to say, we're going to talk about this later on today, but you just got back from Lebanon.
I did, yes.
And how did that go?
It went well. It was a week plus of very intensive discussions with former Lebanese officials, former senior Lebanese military officers. I'll be having parallel discussions in Israel before long, trying to bridge the gap between the two countries, at least in terms of reducing, eliminating violence, and in the fullness of time, eventually moving toward peace.
I went to see Coldplay.
Right?
Well, doing God's work, congratulations. But as far as what did you feel? And again, we're going to discuss this in some length during the program. But do you get a sense of the mood of the room?
I think so. I think most Lebanese are at the point now where they want to see a permanent end to hostilities with Israel. They realize that Lebanon is the big loser from this process. So they want to see a permanent end. Their real question is, what kind of a response are they going to get from Israel? Will it be positive? Will it be okay? Let's think of steps we can take together, or will it be dismissed with scorn and contempt? And this is something I hope to explore in Israel before long.
Well, we appreciate your work, and we appreciate you talking about it, and we look forward to the conversation we'll have in just a little bit.
Joe, I just want to point out what a wimp I am, because Fred here is jetting out to do God's work in Lebanon and Israel, and I don't even want to drive up to Saratoga because of race traffic. I mean, it's really embarrassing. I just want to admit that publicly.
I'm with you, Bob. Yeah, thank goodness we have good people doing great things. Sarah Rogerson is with us. Speaking of, Albany Law School professor, director of the Justice Center. Good morning. How
good
are you?
Good morning. I'm all right.
Excellent. Good to have you here as always. Thank you very much for sharing your time. That goes to all of you. Let's talk about redistricting. This was a story. This story fascinates me for two reasons. One is of what's happening, but also of any topic that we have discussed over the last several weeks, this is the one that seems to be generating the most mail. And I find that to be fascinating because the letters are really all over the place. So with that as a prelude, we go into the discussion. So once again, the Texas GOP is going after the Texas Democrats who have fled the state because they want to avoid a vote on redistricting. The governor of the state of Texas has put out wants to arrest those and those who have left. And this election map fight is swelling into national political warfare, a term used in this morning's Washington Post. It is a push to craft more safe red U.S. House seats. And that's what they were looking to do in Texas. And now that has widened with red and blue states moving to counteract each other, and ambitious politicians vowing aggressive partisan combat. We talked about New York's own Governor Kathy Hochul and her comments yesterday. Monday. We talked about it on Tuesday. Got it. And now we look at California as well. Democrats pushing to redraw their states' maps to add more blue states. If Texas Republicans carve out five more red ones, as they are trying to do, Republicans from Missouri to Ohio have expressed interest in changing their U.S. House district lines to benefit the GOP. And Vice President J.D. Vance is headed Thursday to Indiana, another state that could boost his party. Midterm candidates and potential 2028 presidential contenders are playing to their base and raising their profile while jumping into the fray, and President Trump is weighing in, declaring this week that Republicans are, quote, entitled to draw the maps in Texas. Bob Griffin.
The entitled piece just kind of kills me. This is just a shameless manipulation of a political process. Let's hearken back to why Texas was actually calling for a special legislative session, and that was to try to address the abject failure of Texas and their emergency management system, which led to all of the deaths from the flooding.
Right.
Okay. That was the purpose. And again, we can go back and talk about all of the failures of the Texas system. Trump is obviously hearing from his pollsters and is pushing this mid-decade redistricting, you know, the potential for redistricting as a way of again disenfranchising voters not only in Texas but frankly across the country, which has led to pushback from places like New York and Illinois and California. And it's with very mixed feelings that I say I actually support what the Democrats are doing in Texas, trying to forestall just a blatant redistricting, a partisan redistricting. Joe, unfortunately, what it feels more and more like though is that the gulf between red and blue truly is slipping into a political civil war, and the terminology that was used by Governor Hochul, that this is war, unfortunately is resonating with me. It scares me because long term I don't know what brings the country back.
This is war. Bring it on.
Yeah, and to me, it's what government should be doing is taking care of its people, and that should be the priority, and that seems to be, you know, sort of a tertiary concern right now. In a perverse way, though, I think it shines a really important light on gerrymandering in all states. Although it's interesting listening to legislators in Texas, and I watched a couple of videos from them trying to defend this, they're not making many apologies. They're doing this simply to try to hold on to a Republican majority in Texas. It's not about voters. It's not about balancing their districts, and they're also going after California, saying that they're gerrymandered, or Illinois they're gerrymandered. But I will note that California has an independent redistricting process that would require legislative change in order to redistrict. And I will also note that in New York, I personally blame the failed attempts at gerrymandering the New York districts as giving control of the House to the Republicans. I think that there was enough strength in the old maps that enough Democrats could have won that would have kept the House blue.
Sarah?
Yeah, I'm worried. Okay, I support what the Democrats are doing in Texas, actually 1,000%. I think this is the type of courage that we need to see from the Democratic Party, people who are looking for leadership. Should take this actually as a model. There's at a certain point it gets so ridiculous that you have to resort to tactics that are untraditional, that seem out of the norm. And Governor Pritzker, I think, was offering assistance. This is becoming a nationwide response to a nationwide problem. The rhetoric of war, though, bothers me. It's bothered me for a long time. I actually, I'm going to bring it back to poetry, as I sometimes do. Ocean Vuong was interviewed by Krista Tippett on her podcast On Being, which I'm a devotee of. And he spoke about, Ocean Vuong is a poet, and he spoke about the importance of language. And sort of paying attention to when we're using language of violence, and to see whether or not that's really warranted. I mean, we started this morning talking about Hiroshima. I understand why the term political warfare gets traction, but if we really sat down and thought about it, it's a really dangerous way to speak about really important but not necessarily violent subjects, right? And it tends to be, I think, when the Democrats are making moves that are quote unquote aggressive, that's when the language turns to war instead of sports metaphors. And like, there's a fine line between those two. Sports is friendly competition, sometimes gets tense. War is war. This isn't war, to be clear.
Right.
And I there's a grandiosity of political rhetoric involved in this whole conversation that makes me really uncomfortable, because I think it signals that our political leadership doesn't actually appreciate what war is. It's like they're treating it lightly. I think it's time for some light civil disobedience, which is basically what the Democrats in Texas are doing, because it's so absurd.
So I want to get to Freva. We'll do that after the break. But let me just quickly ask you, is anything they are doing, the governor, Abbott, is trying to do this, but is there anything they are doing that is illegal?
I don't know the parliamentary rules in the state of Texas. But if there were any, I can't imagine that there are criminal consequences in the parliamentary rules for the Texas state legislature. I just Maybe there are.
But Joe, after we come after
but if there were, they would be in Texas.
Well, as I was saying that, I was thinking we in Texas. You also have to think about the Texas Rangers. You have to think about other types of laws that we don't think about every day. When I take the Texas,
but after we come back and do Fred, we do need to talk about Trump's threat of the FBI and this idea of misuse of law enforcement. Though that's a really important point to come back to.
Yeah.
Well, all good stuff. We'll get to Fred. We'll get to these other issues. And, of course, we'll get to your letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We would love to hear your thoughts. We do ask that you keep them short and to the point. That way we can get to as many as possible. As I mentioned earlier, this is a subject that a lot of people want to write in about. So we welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after some brief messages and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to our panel discussion this morning, talking about Texas redistricting and the redistricting fever that is taking over the nation. We have heard from both Bob and Sarah some other topics that we want to get into, but I want to check in with Fred Hoff.
Well, sure, Joe. I agree with Bob and Sarah that what Texas is doing is provoking an entirely unnecessary political battle with all of this. It's something that the Wall Street Journal today is referring to as a war of mutually assured political destruction. What the Journal has in mind is that when Republicans and Democrats carve up safe districts, what they're really doing is putting power in the hands of extremists on both the right and the left, who wield disproportionate power and influence during primary elections. In safe districts, primaries often turn out to be everything. I think there's already too much gerrymandering going on. Although President Trump and Texas Republicans deserve plenty of blame for trying to rig the game for 2026, they're not the only abusers. Now, I don't know if deliberate gerrymandering is going on here, but for example, in terms of House seats, Illinois has 14 Democrats and 3 Republicans, despite the fact that 43% of the voters went for Donald Trump in 2024. California, which is making a big issue about what's going on in Texas, has 43 Democrats and 9 Republicans, although Trump got 38% of the vote in 2024. Next door in Massachusetts, it's 9-0, although Trump got 36% of the vote in the last presidential election. In Nevada, it's 3-1, even though Trump carried the state. I think to be fair about it, this kind of partisan gamesmanship seems to be cooked into our system. It's been going on since the early 1800s, and I'm sorry to say we're never going to get rid of it completely. Congress does, however, have the constitutional ability to pass a law that says that states can do this, but only once every 10 years. And I'm sorry to say that may be as good as it can possibly get.
Okay, but wait a minute.
Yes.
So valid points in terms of the gamesmanship that goes on in different states. But I think there's a disconnect between the seats currently held and the presidential vote for lots of other reasons, I think, right? So I'm not sure that that's I think there are a lot of other factors to keep in mind when we're talking about like what a fair district map looks like. And there's a reason why that goes to census data as opposed to election outcomes, because there's there's not, especially when Trump is involved, there's not, it's not as clear whether people are not going to the polls as opposed to or changing their votes, or you have a lot of different things in the mix when it comes to presidential elections when Trump is a candidate that aren't necessarily connected to the way that the districts shake out. So I would want to be careful about drawing those lines and think more about, I don't know how this works to the in terms of the nitty gritty detail when they sit down and look at the maps, but I would be interested in whether they look at local election data, whether they look at outcomes county by county, because I think that's probably a clearer view of where the majority stands than presidential elections, which get weird for all kinds of reasons and are so close by the margins that it's just really hard statistically to sort out and make correlation between outcomes in presidentials and what's fair from a redistricting standpoint. That being said, I guess I also disagree that it's mutually assured destruction, as the Washington Post is making the case for, because these aren't equal opponents. There's one team that's subverting democracy at every turn. There's one team that has consistently voted to suppress voters, specifically voters in poor and minority majority communities. There's one team that's using the dirtiest tactics, and that's the Republicans. So I see it differently. Instead of mutually assured destruction, I see it maybe the cautionary tale is the Democrats, you know, racing to the bottom in some way. But as someone who's represented protesters, I don't see it that way. I see this as like one of the most American things that the Texas Democrats can do, which is finally stand up against the bullies who have gotten us in this position to begin with consistently. And that goes straight to presidentials. That goes back to Reagan. That goes back to certainly Trump 1.0 and the Bushes. Like I as long as I've been alive, there's been one team who is working to keep the vote on their side.
Well, my disagreement with you, Sarah, though, is that the one team that's gerrymandering are the politicians. I would argue that it does happen on both sides. I agree with you that about the concerns about correlation of presidential votes versus districting. This is why I think it, nonpartisan. Methodology that has contiguous districts that are population based. Honestly, you know, sticking into an AI system and what comes out should be the district. I think it would go far for the country to return districts to sort of blind to partisan politics. As a way of forcing a moderation of who is elected, because when you do look at it, I agree with the comment that the gerrymandering has made districts so safe, and with the power of incumbency, that we continue to see people who frankly I think are completely unfit to serve in any capacity, being elected to positions that were once, you know, I think people who I greatly respected, and we're seeing that at all levels. Again, I'm not naive enough to say that that's going to happen, but in a perfect world, there would be a single national methodology for redistricting. It would be independent commissions. I'm even at the point now where I'm a supporter of term limits, where in the past I have never supported that because I felt that it took away from the voters' rights. But there's so much money there, the the balance of power has been taken away from the people by the politicians. And it is, you know, this is just an example of blatantly ignoring the will of the people because of their own power.
I totally get that. And again, because this is Texas, it's different, right? Like, if it were North Jersey, the Democratic machine there has is strong. Mm-hmm. And but what that does is it removes the choice of the voter by making the election the primary, really. And, you know, feeding money towards the politicians that the party machine thinks will do its bidding, right? I don't love that. I've worked against that type of politics my entire adult life, really. But in Texas, they don't. It's not that the machine is not. I mean, I haven't lived there for a while, and I haven't been involved in Democratic politics there in a while. Better part of the last 20 years, I've been away from there. But I just there. It's not the same thing, because what's happening is a state where votes have been suppressed systematically, and the party that's morally in the right is taking a moral stand, which happens a lot in the state of Texas. I forget her name. I will figure it out at a break. But, you know, that's where we saw one of the nationwide actual filibusters against restricting access to abortion. Yes. Right. Wendy Davis, was that her name, who stood for like 48 hours mm-hmm. in the Texas state legislature. So, you know, it's a unique place for this to happen that is separate and apart from all the other things we hate about politics and politicians.
Well, in Texas is its own special cesspool of politics. I mean, think about Ken Paxton, who should have been impeached. Okay, and you know, think about the situation that he's in. He's the one making determinations, and this gets back to I think one of the points that is not being looked at enough. It's this threat of law enforcement. It's this threat of arrest of elected officials. It's Trump talking about using the FBI. Why would the FBI be involved in this? This isn't the federal government and the FBI has no role in this other than Trump thinking that any lever of government can be used to his advantage. But it's being replicated in Texas by Abbott saying that he's going to he wants to strip seats away from duly elected people. We saw DeSantis do this. In Florida, but this idea of being able to threaten elected officials with arrest, you know, goes all the way back to the founding of the country of what we were trying to avoid with with the Articles of Confederation, but certainly with the Constitution, which is going to have a chilling effect on our national policies and politics if it's allowed to continue.
Yeah, and I'd just like to say, Sarah, I agree with you entirely. We don't have, unlike Germany, for example, we don't have a proportional system in allocating our seats in the national legislature. But it just strikes me that the numbers are suggestive. 43-9 in California. It suggests to me, and I take your points entirely, but I still come to the conclusion that Democrats nationwide are not exactly angels on this issue. We saw just a few years ago what I considered to be an absolutely disgraceful attempt to gerrymander New York congressional yeah. districts. One that was rolled back, and as Bob points out, it wound up swinging the House of Representatives to the Republicans, and I think Democrats will have every reason to scream bloody murder on this issue if Texas gets away from it. Right now in Texas, the delegation is 25 Republicans, 12 Democrats, one vacancy. I mean, Democrats in 2024, early on, were talking about the possibility of possibly maybe even carrying Texas. All right. 25-12 will go 30-7 if this thing works the way Governor Abbott wants it to work. Democrats will scream about this, but I think they need occasionally to look in the mirror and see if 43-9 in California is appropriate, and 14-3 in Illinois is appropriate.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get to all those letters I mentioned. We welcome yours as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. I promised letters. I want to get to a point that Bob brought up during a previous break that I said I would get to and then I didn't, which was about the Trump's involvement in this, and specifically in terms of the FBI.
Yeah, this idea that Trump is threatening the use of the FBI in a situation that clearly is not a federal jurisdiction. And to me, again, it's this misuse of law enforcement. It's also, in my mind, and certainly when we start to talk about ICE, it's my growing concern for both the law enforcement community that is now going to be put in a position where the populace does not trust law enforcement because of the way it's being used, but it's also the abuse of law enforcement, and the expectation that should there be a change in administrations in D.C., that law enforcement is continued to be misused in order to pay back what is occurring right now to 50% of the population. And this eye for an eye certainly will only lead to a nation of blind people if we're not careful.
All right, let's go to the letters that we have before us this morning. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I am in full agreement with Sarah, says Lisa. Language creates our reality. I would also include the warlike language used in political campaigning. Battleground states, campaign war chests, in the trenches. My God, it drives me nuts. That's from Lisa. I added the my God. Okay.
sounded right, though.
Full disclosure. Yeah, it did, didn't it? I was just, yeah. Sarah says, would ranked choice voting defeat gerrymandering?
Oh, I think it leads to another kind. We've got experiments on that in New York City.
Yes.
That I'm sure people are still studying as we speak. I mean, there's a lot. Politicians are going to politic, and until the masses hold them accountable, which, you know, Americans are sort of just disconnected because of capitalism and entertainment, honestly.
Yeah.
Until politics becomes as entertaining as Netflix, we're going to continue to see this disconnect between what politicians do and what we want.
And it's an interesting point. It just strikes me off the top of my head that ranked choice voting really can help sort out things in primary elections. In the final election, though, you basically, except in rare cases, you're down to two candidates.
Greg says, as a conservative New York resident, it's disgusting to me that the response from New York and California to the Texas redistricting is, well, if they're going to undermine democracy in Texas, we're going to fight back and undermine democracy in our states, as if I'm no longer entitled to representation at the federal level. By giving more representation to New York Democratic voters in D.C., they are taking representation away from New York conservatives. That from Greg.
That's a fair point.
It cuts both ways.
Yep.
It's mutually assured destruction.
It is. But if I'm a California resident and I'm saying, listen, you know, California returns, I think using Newsom's number, you know, something like $83 billion to the federal, you know, gets back from the federal government $83 billion less than it sends, Texas gets $79 billion with this blatant manipulation of and support of red states versus blue states by the Trump administration. You're looking at it saying, you know, we can't afford to continue to fund these other states because they don't have the political will to tax the people the way they should. So, I mean, there's an economic issue here as well. There's certainly a fairness issue, and this gets back to the concern I have about what are we as a national identity right now? We're not a United States. We're red versus blue. And it's being these flames are being fanned by Trump and MAGA, and it's absolutely blatant. And what do you expect? I mean, if you're going to change the rules to fit you, then why do you think that nobody else is going to try to change the rules too?
Melissa writes a letter that I just love. It says, "Dear panel, I'm really confused. Am I alone in this? I'm not sure what's going on, but it feels like Twilight Zone is taking over by not too smart aliens. Thanks for bringing some light to the confusion. I wish it made more sense. Also, hi, Mom. I know you're listening."
That's terrific. That's a great letter.
But
well, there's also layers.
She's not wrong.
Well, there's layers of nuance. I think so. I'm one of those nerdy people that has been following politics on like a granular level for a really long time.
Sure.
And there's like a very specific subset of Americans who do that and get really nerdy about it. And if you're entering that world for the first time right now, or even if you just haven't been as engaged and you're trying to re-engage right now, it is a very strange place to be.
It is a strange place to be, but I would say that all four of us who have watched this and have put that in, you know, have been in it for a long time, it's impossible to say that it's not confusing. It's still confusing.
It's like there's a football metaphor here. Of course there is. I think there's some stadium where it's like from the outside looking in, it's hard to tell. And from the inside looking out, we can't explain it to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it feels like right now. And I should say, I don't agree. I think it comes down to specificity of language. So just to hold myself to my own standards, I don't think that the California-New York response is helpful from the Democrats. I think it makes things worse, right? I agree with that. But I still stand by the Texas Democrats because for them and their constituents, this is the right move historically and currently.
All I know is now I've got the Twilight Zone theme going on in my head, and it's very disturbing. Yeah.
Another time. Okay. Sam writes, "Concerns over whether or not the word war is appropriate or dangerous is classic liberal pearl clutching. Ocean Vuong is unbelievably overrated." I don't. That's not true.
That, no.
By the way, and I'm not just saying that because he's a listener.
Is
but,
he?
Yeah, he lives in Northampton. Yeah. Yeah, very cool. The left needs to resist resorting to worthless semantics and fight MAGA gerrymandering.
Can I just say, I don't agree that Ocean Vuong is overrated.
Nor do I.
But I do agree that the war narratives are, liberal pearl clutching?
Yes.
Okay, there's a lot of pearl clutching, especially in Texas. I'm just going to, on both sides.
Right.
But the listener is correct. Like when we use this exaggerated language, and this is Ocean Vuong's point, which is why he's so genius, it dilutes the point. It actually does the opposite of what we're hoping it will do. We are using this big language to try to make these points more resonant. And instead, it not only drags down the point you're trying to make, but it also denigrates actual warfare and the people that fought in those wars.
And I just it's interesting. I'll also note that for a while in American politics, we avoided the term war. If you think about it, we called them policing actions. Korea wasn't called the conflict in Korea was not considered a war. Vietnam
police. Was police action.
A police action. the language that was being used by Bush in the Middle East. I mean, we went out of our way not to call things war.
But wasn't that political language to try to get around international rules regarding?
Absolutely, because the idea of going to war was so abhorrent to both the political leadership but the population that we called it anything but. Okay, now it's everything is war, which I again makes it cheapens in my mind the fact that if this country is called to face an adversary in war, that it's going to be minimized. And I go back and for people who think, okay, well, he's just a pearl clutcher. Read Guns of August. Talk about what happened in Europe prior to World War I with this idea that war had become so glorified, okay, that the human impact wasn't recognized until a whole generation of pretty much 16 to 24-year-olds were wiped out in the fields of France.
Yeah, I think the best thing out there on this subject is George Orwell's essay, 1946, on politics and the English language. And I would strongly recommend anyone interested in this subject to go ahead and read Orwell's essay.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss with this group. And we'll get back to it right after a few messages and news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 6th of August. It is 8 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, is with us. Diplomat in residence at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff, and actually that's former, I apologize, former, and...
Definitely an ex.
Yeah.
Of the State Department.
Well, if we're going to be specific, Joe, I am a ray of sunshine, too.
Yeah.
That should be in my title.
Ray of sunshine. our forever ray of sunshine. And Sarah Rogerson, Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center. It is a delight to have you all here discussing the matters of the world. Let us continue our conversation. And we are going to change subjects, although we can get back to some letters in a few minutes about redistricting, because we do have many of them. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Ambassador Hoff just returned from Lebanon, and he talked a little bit about the work that he was doing. And then there's the story about a weakened Hezbollah resists pressure to give up its weapons. The Lebanese militant group has lost much of its power since the recent war in Israel, but it is balking at demands to surrender whatever is left of its once formidable arsenal. And this story just from yesterday, and I'm interested in getting your perspective on that and overall the situation in Lebanon.
Sure, and I should state at the outset, just for the record, I'm not a U.S. official. Last time I was in government was in 2012. And going to Lebanon and eventually Israel is not some kind of a secret mission. I just got back from Beirut after a week plus of some very intensive and interesting discussions with former senior Lebanese officials, former senior military officers, centering on the issues of what really needs to be done to pacify relations with Israel so that both countries can avoid violence, eventually move toward peace, so that Lebanese who have had to flee southern Lebanon can return to their homes, and Israelis who have been displaced from northern Israel can return home. This is something that's known as Track 2 diplomacy. It's an effort at the strictly unofficial level to do the homework on issues that are not yet being discussed in detail at the official level. I'm working with a former Canadian diplomat who recruited me to this thing, and we're focusing on a potential Israel-Lebanon armistice and on territorial disputes between the two countries. But while we were there, while we talked to all these people, we heard a lot about the issue of Hezbollah disarmament, which is something being discussed at the official level. For over 40 years, Iran built up Hezbollah as its political military proxy in Lebanon. It built it up to the point where it was eventually far superior in military capabilities to the Lebanese army. It could even stand up to Israel in 2000. Mm-hmm. It succeeded in ending Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon in 2006. It fought Israel to a bloody draw in a war that lasted several weeks. But in 2023, October 2023, it made what may prove to have been a fatal mistake. A day after the Hamas atrocities in Israel, Hezbollah began firing rockets into northern Israel. And this caused about 80,000 Israelis to flee from their homes. Israel's military response took several forms, but the bottom line is clear. Hezbollah was defeated decisively, and its charismatic leader, Hassan Nasrallah, was assassinated. Today, Hezbollah is, militarily speaking, a shell of what it once was. But it still has a lot of political support in Lebanon's dispossessed Shia community. And it's still heavily armed. Despite a ceasefire that was reached last year, Israel continues to hit Hezbollah personnel and positions almost on a daily basis. Lebanon has a new president, a fellow named Joseph Aoun, who used to command the army, who has pledged to establish an arms monopoly for the Lebanese state. And I must say, this is one of those things that's a lot easier said than done. Hezbollah says it wants to stay armed until Israeli attacks stop and until Israeli forces evacuate their positions in southern Lebanon. Israel says it's not going to stop these things until Hezbollah disarms. The United States and Saudi Arabia are saying at the official level that Lebanon will not get a dime in reconstruction aid until Hezbollah disarms. So we have a really complex chicken and egg situation here.
Fred, for our listeners, though, could you say a few sentences about the issue of the Saudi Arabia versus Iran and the role that the Shiite-Sunni conflict fits there, too?
Sure. Saudi, you know, Hezbollah's constituents in Lebanon.
He's taking requests.
Are almost entirely Shia Muslims. Saudi Arabia considers itself to be the leader of the Sunni Muslim world. Now, Saudi Arabia and Iran have reached a bit of a detente. But Saudi Arabia is also very, very interested in seeing Hezbollah in Lebanon completely erased, at least as a military force. Yesterday, the Lebanese cabinet met and told the Lebanese army, go and develop a plan to disarm Hezbollah by the end of 2025. This will probably disappoint both the Saudis and our own government in terms of being too slow. Figuratively speaking, they want to see Hezbollah disarmed in the next 20 minutes. but no one with whom we spoke in Lebanon wants to see a renewed Lebanese civil war, obviously. And no one we spoke with is absolutely sure that the Lebanese army would prevail over Hezbollah if push comes to shove. So, you know, in conclusion, one way forward is to try to consolidate the ceasefire in southern Lebanon, where Hezbollah, in fact, has been almost completely marginalized. Lebanese troops can replace Israeli soldiers in a kind of a step-by-step process. The two countries can begin armistice negotiations. Israel could pause its airstrikes for a period of time. These are the kinds of ideas my Canadian partner in this thing and I are trying to develop in detail as we speak with well-connected Israelis and Lebanese, trying to find if in fact there's a basis to move forward that would be mutually satisfactory to both countries.
When it comes to the situation that you're looking at overall, how, as you're having your discussions, and especially having your discussions with Canada, how do you even discuss or the level of understanding of what the Israeli position is and what the United States position is? I mean, I assume you have to take that at its face value, and yet still there's a lot there you don't know.
Yeah, there's stuff we don't know across the board. I mean, both my Canadian colleague and I have worked on these issues literally for decades. But it's one of these classic situations where you know, the more you learn, the more you realize that you don't know everything. Our job is to gather information here, not to come in with a prescription, not to come in with our cure for what ails Lebanon and Israel. We're in the information gathering business, and we hope to come up with some ideas that we can pass on to the U.S. government and to anybody else who's interested in mediating this thing at the official level. But our only official connection in this to date. While I was in Beirut, I was able, my Canadian colleague and I were able to visit with the American ambassador just to make sure that in our discussions we were not unintentionally trampling on something that was happening at the official level. And she told us, no. Go ahead, full speed ahead. Let us know what you find out.
That's fascinating to me, because at a time when the State Department is being shrunk again, which happened under the first Trump administration, I'm curious as to whether this government, it's just curious to me that this government wouldn't be or feel threatened by your presence and your work. Especially,
yeah, we're not seeing that so far, and this kind of activity takes place, really in all administrations, regardless of the.
That was going to be my next
regardless
question.
Regardless of the state of the State Department, the idea is that sometimes there are issues that are just so sensitive, just so difficult that the official level, official diplomatic exchanges haven't gotten to the point where they can be addressed. And this is an opportunity for people at the unofficial level to meet with former officials, former military officers, people who are well connected to their own governments, and put these issues on the table and have, you know, frank discussions just to see if ideas can come up out of this that can be fed into the official system.
So I think
over the years this Track 2 approach has produced produce some good results.
Right. I was going to say, I know that that happens in the legal spaces on a human rights level, where you have these unofficial conversations that lead to the formation of on the ground type positive activities that create change from the ground up. And so I was wondering if that worked the same. And I'm going to say something that's not very popular, because I know we get a lot of letters on this, but this is really like the benefit of that professional class that Trump hates, you know, the so-called professional elites working in academia and government. This is real work that impacts people's everyday lives that you just don't see a lot in the news media, because you can't talk about it as much.
It's a great point.
It's a really important point. And having someone of Fred's statue and capability, he can go in and have conversations that the diplomats can't. I mean, because he doesn't have to worry about sort of representing the pride of the country or the insults, and you know, are considered different. I'd also note, Joe, that you know, we've had many, many conversations about USAID and this idea of foreign aid, and it strikes me that this is a prime example of we've taken a chess piece off the board, our own chess piece off the board, by eliminating humanitarian and other aid that could be used as an incentive for Lebanon to further look at de-escalation of the situation between Hezbollah and Israel, but also standing up their own government, and this is where we're really weakened ourselves. And when you take years of experience out of the civil service, out of the bureaucracy, out of the trained diplomatic corps, in addition to taking the aid out, you know, we've really hamstrung ourselves. The other thing that I'll toss on, so people understand how complex the work that Fred's doing is, you have the situation of this isn't just Israel versus Hezbollah. You have the situation of Hezbollah versus the Muslim versus the Catholic, the Christian. So you've got sectarian issues between Christians in Lebanon and the Muslim world, but then you have the Sunni versus Shiite conflict, and then you have Israel. It takes an awful lot to be able to start to pull those knots apart in order to get even people to talk to each other. So the idea of informally being able to go in and say, "Hey, what would it take to be able to do this?"
No, listen, in our discussions, for example, with Lebanese Shia, okay, and I have not reached out to Hezbollah for discussions, and I don't think I will. I think there are American laws that that impact there, but Lebanese Shia, with whom we spoke, a former general, Lebanese army general, a former senior official, they wanted to make it clear how vulnerable Lebanese Shia feel at this point. We're talking at about a third of the population, generally speaking, at the poorer end of the economic scale in Lebanon. They look at what's going on in Syria, okay, with violence being directed at some Syrian minorities. They wonder if they're next, okay? They wonder if, from the point of their own survival, does it make sense for Hezbollah to disarm at this point? Okay, and this is just an example of how complex it is. The Lebanese president, who is a Catholic, has reached out to the Shia community and said, "Please, please, stay with me on this." The Lebanese state, the Lebanese army, will protect you, will see to your welfare. All right. The Lebanese state is broke. There is no money. The United States has been consistently supportive of the Lebanese army, and this is very, 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 very important. Okay? But as much as I would like to see Hezbollah disarmed, I mean, Hezbollah is responsible for the violent, terrible deaths of a couple of friends of mine. Okay? As much as I want to see these people put out of business permanently, I can understand the average Lebanese Shia saying, wow, if they're disarmed, what happens to me?
And Joe, this is also where you know, I really push back against this whole idea of this gross misuse of tariffs as well, because part of what the United States can bring to the table as we start to think about trying to create a more lasting peace in Lebanon are trade deals that give the Lebanese markets an opportunity to grow that frankly really don't impact our own markets, but it creates money that flows in, which creates jobs, which creates stability, which adds to peace in ways that Fred were talking about. But what the administration has done is that we've taken a lot of the tools that we have besides military off the table in ways that I think are going to cost us in the long term.
Let's see. We have about 3 minutes, and I have two letters here. First of all, Jerome says, I want to take the time to mention how fortunate we are to have someone in Fred who is not 1, 2, or 3 degrees away from the negotiations, but right in the heart of it. Thank you to Joe, WAMC, and the panel that you bring on to discuss issues of the day. Wow, just wow. I was just thinking that as I was listening to Fred talk. Mm-hmm. Wow, just wow. Then we go to James, who has a question for Fred. Can anyone on the panel, Fred, please enlighten us where are Hamas and Hezbollah getting their weapons from? It would seem that they don't have the ability to manufacture their own rockets. So where are they getting their guns from, and who are the companies making money from selling them weapons? To solve this, maybe we should, quote, follow the money.
Yeah, Israel is armed principally by the United States. It also has a thriving domestic arms production market. Hamas got many of its arms down through the years from Iran. It also has some domestic production capabilities. One thing I discovered a long time ago, 25 years ago, when I was chief of staff of an international committee that was investigating why the Second Intifada violent uprising took place in Israel. And where Palestinian gunmen were getting arms from, and one of the things we discovered, one of the things we were told by Israeli law enforcement people, was that Israeli criminal elements were making money on some arms transfers as well.
We're going to take a break there. When we come back, we'll have our last half hour with our incredible panel. We welcome your questions, panel at WAMC.org, your letters, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll get to those. We'll move on to other topics as well. Panel at WAMC.org is where you can address those. Keep them short, to the point. We'll get to as many as we possibly can. We'll hear a few messages and then go to news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Bob Griffin, Fred Hoff, and Sarah Rogerson with us. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we thank you for being with us. Let's move on to other topics of the day. So we'll put we'll go from one expert to another and move over to Sarah Rogerson to start off the conversation when it comes to Trump's new tactic to separate immigrant families. This was an article that I found to be fascinating and frightening in the New York Times. The practice appears to be a more targeted version of the mass separation of migrant children from their parents from President Trump's first term, which caused a global outcry. And so there is this couple, and immigration and customs enforcement officers told them they could leave the United States with their child and return to their native Russia, which they had fled seeking political asylum, or they could remain in immigration detention in the United States, but their 8-year-old son would be taken away and sent to a shelter for unaccompanied children. Their case is an example of a little-known tactic the Trump administration is using to pressure undocumented immigrants to leave the United States. Officials have begun separating children from their families in small numbers across the country in what appears to be a more targeted version of that policy that we mentioned a moment ago. The New York Times has uncovered at least 9 cases in which parents have been separated from their children after they refused to comply with deportation orders, according to internal government documents, case files, and interviews. The practice is not as widespread as the zero-tolerance policy of Mr. Trump's first term, when thousands of children were systematically taken from their parents as they crossed the U.S.-Mexico border and sent to shelters and foster homes. But the new cases suggest that the administration has decided to use family separation as one tool, at least in some instances, to persuade families to leave and to create a powerful deterrent for those who might come to the United States illegally. It seems like that is certainly understated of just how powerful a deterrent that could be.
Yep. So I wrote extensively about this the first time it happened. There are a couple of things that are going on here. You know, they avoid a lot of legal rights and challenges. And in the time between the first Trump administration and the second Trump administration, something really important has happened, which is a lot of challenges to protections and safeguards around the detention of minors and the rights that minor children have in detention. A lot of other things have happened, including an erosion of the international right to family unity, which doesn't get enough attention, but it exists, and it's something that the United States is obligated to respect, whether they're separating families internationally or whether they're doing it at the interior, which is what's happening here. What the current policy is doing is saying to families currently in the United States, you have a choice. You can leave the United States with your kid. And in the case that was covered, it was a Russian family who was here seeking political asylum, which is a legitimate way to come to this country. These folks would not be considered, quote unquote, illegal aliens under the laws of the United States of America. Even though, you know, we are wildly irresponsible in how we talk about immigrants in this country. So I just want to make that clear that these are this is a family that's following a legal process that we have in the United States that presumably are here lawfully pursuing asylum. And the Trump administration is saying, well, you can keep doing that, but if you're going to pursue asylum, we're going to detain you and separate you from your child because we can, and or you can go back to Russia altogether as a family and face whatever, you know, take your chances with whatever persecution you might find there, knowing full well about Russia, its tactics, and how it treats its citizenry. So it's a false choice. And what the Trump administration is doing is putting the onus on parents and saying, oh, it's not our fault that families are being separated. It's the parents' own fault. It's a double cruelty. At least under the first policy, it was clear that the government was making the separation. Under this policy, they're able to normatively blame parents. Blame parents who left their country to seek safety for their children, specifically. And it's going to create all sorts of perverse incentives, again, for these mega detention companies that are making billions and billions and billions of dollars, including free forced labor, by the way, that occurs in these detention facilities where people who are detained there are mopping floors and taking care of janitorial services for less than a dollar a day, sometimes for nothing in many cases. It's another way for the Trump administration to funnel billions of dollars to CoreCivico and Geo Group and these big companies that are getting paid to house people and justifying it politically by saying it's the parents' fault. It's doubly cruel. I thought it couldn't get worse, and now it's worse.
Sarah, I have a question, if I may. It's not clear to me from the story in the New York Times whether the claim to asylum was ever adjudicated. I mean, I guess it wasn't. But what's the procedure here? I mean, you've got people coming from Russia saying, you know, we've been politically persecuted in Russia. We're here requesting asylum. Isn't there supposed to be a procedure to adjudicate
all
that
kinds
claim?
Yeah, in fact, there's a big, huge textbook that you could prop a door open called Law of Asylum in the United States. There's an entire semester's worth of laws and rules and case law that are that one could teach on this. The problem is that the Trump administration, so the asylum process takes a very long time.
Okay.
There's two different ways to apply. You can apply affirmatively, meaning you came into the country and you are not under the detection of immigration. No one's trying to actively deport you from the United States. Or you can apply defensively if you are brought to the attention of immigration authorities and are placed in removal proceedings before an immigration judge. On the affirmative side, if you are not successful affirmatively applying, you are automatically placed in a defensive position. So depending on a lot of different factors, and then never mind the issue of being paroled into the country and then seeking asylum, there's like a whole bunch of different ways that our broken immigration laws interfere with the right to asylum. On top of that, the Trump administration, because the attorney general by code, by law, by Congress, has so much discretion in the immigration system, the attorney general's office is, under Trump administrations, is consistently trying to erode what rights do exist for asylum seekers in the United States by, you know, futzing, for lack of a better term, with their policies on who can seek asylum, what is a legitimate claim, how it is adjudicated. And so all of these cooks in the immigration kitchen mean that the dinner takes longer to get to the table. Mm. And so like during that time, I mean, your asylum application could be pending for 5-6 years.
Wow.
And so the Trump administration is betting on that. They're building that into the system by making it longer for asylum claims to process and every other claim under the sun. It's not just asylum. And in the meantime, they're saying you can self-deport, like take your chances. And mandatory detention has a big role to play. So under our crappy immigration system, the Trump administration can, in many cases, say, we're going to detain you while your case is pending, which means you could be detained for 5 or 6 years while your case is pending. It's awful.
And in a case like that, obviously a child is going to be separated from parents under detention.
And they make it sound fun. Like, oh, these kids are going to go to a child-friendly detention facility. They're going to a farm. They're going to a camp. Mm-hmm. It's not fun. It's not fun for these kids. And it's well documented that what happens is abuse in these facilities.
And that's, I think, you know, as a parent, I think, My heart goes out to the family, but also, you know, how badly are we messing up this little 8-year-old boy, and yeah. and being basically ripped away from his parents? What ICE is doing, you know, and I actually think Donald Trump is too stupid to come up with these policies. I think this is Miller,
Stephen Miller,
and Vogt and and I don't think Homan's smart enough to come up with them. I think he's just evil enough to implement it. These are un-American, unethical, immoral policies, Joe. I mean, at the end of the day, this is not what this country stands for.
I mean, it kind of is. I mean, we do it domestically. I think it's important. I always think it's important to raise the point that our family law system writ large is broken. And we do separate poor and black and brown families every day in this country by operation of law. You know, the forcible detention is a next level. Certainly, there are fewer grounds to keep each and every single family member detained in a separate location somewhere else around the country when it comes to American family law. But it still happens every day. It's important to also note that we have an American problem of government interfering with family unity systematically. And that disproportionately harms, you know, poor folks, undocumented folks, and anyone who doesn't have access to a lawyer, which in the case of immigration is like everyone.
And also note, Joe, that we're now talking about building up an enforcement loosely, agency in ICE that is looking at an annual budget of $28 billion. And I've said for a while now that I felt that ICE was a feral organization. I'm at the point now where I don't think I think that ICE needs to be abolished. I think the elements of ICE that need to be kept in place need to be rethought in a brand new agency. And frankly, I think anyone involved in ICE need to be terminated, contracts and employees included. What they're doing, and when you're looking at the buildup of ICE agents and how they're advertising and look who they're looking to attract, it's going to lead to nothing but problems for this country.
Yeah, and it strikes me. I mean, even if we were to accept the government's position that what it's doing in this case, this New York Times article, what it's doing in this case is right and proper. Even if we were to accept that, I mean, it doesn't mean that these governmental actions regarding deportation are wise and effective. Peggy Noonan, conservative columnist in the conservative Wall Street Journal, just very recently wrote about the un-American stupidity of focusing mass deportation on places where undocumented people are working and paying taxes. Un-American stupidity. And, you know, likewise, regardless of what the law says, regardless of the government's position, it strikes me that we need to have some adults present before families are separated. This is just shameful.
We're going to take a break there. We'll come back and finish up the show. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. And to our panel discussion, we have, I don't know, 7 or 8 minutes left and time for, I believe, at least one more topic for our group this morning. And we can talk about this D.C. takeover that is being threatened by the president of the United States. I just want to, for no other reason than just a little background, but I was born in Washington, D.C., and even though I grew up in Philadelphia, I was born in Washington, D.C. I have very strong ties to Washington, D.C. I lived there for a long time. And so all of this just seems odd to me, and I don't know quite how to process it. But the president's threat of a federal takeover comes after an attack on a Doge worker. Trump floats taking federal control over the city after the man known online as Big Balls was injured in a carjacking. Elon Musk also says D.C. should be taken over. Well, with a setup like that, a protege of Elon Musk and former Doge staffer was injured in an attempted carjacking early Sunday morning in D.C., a police report said, in an attack that was captured that has captured the attention of the president and re-inspired his threats to take over the nation's capital. If D.C. doesn't get its act together, and quickly, we will have no choice but to take federal control of the city and run the city how it should be run and put criminals on notice that they're not going to get away with this anymore. Trump said this morning on Truth Social. Billionaire Elon Musk, who helmed the U.S. Doge service, wrote on X that a Doge, quote, team member was attacked, and Musk called to federalize D.C. A police report identified the victim as Edward Korestein, who is known within the administration as the aforementioned Big Balls.
He is 19. Yeah. He's a 19. So he's a 19-year-old kid who somehow got the attention of Elon Musk. He was. It sounds like two 15-year-olds were arrested. So we're talking. I'd like to recast the story through the lens of community violence. This is exactly why community violence prevention measures are necessary for young people. It does not appear to have been a targeted political attack, but of course that's what Trump is going to make it into. But I do think that it's important, again, just with the theme of this morning's roundtable, not to let the political rhetoric command our attention more than what's actually happening on the ground. Two 15-year-olds allegedly beat up a 19-year-old in the streets of Washington, D.C. The 19-year-old just happens to be very close to powerful and influential people in our nation's capital. That leads to all kinds of mischief, mayhem, and another opportunity for a power grab for the president, just like he's done when, by chance, a typically white, typically young person under the age of 25 is attacked by someone who happens to be an immigrant. It's the same kind of setup. But I do want to make sure that it's clear that this 19-year-old kid who got mixed up with Elon Musk, who's apparently very bright, has, you know, every right to be looked after as the 15-year-olds who came after him. So I'm a little concerned about the story on multiple levels, but I want to make sure that we remember that these are kids.
You know, the first thing that occurred to me is I'm old enough to remember when presidents of the United States had better things to do than read and comment on a local police blotter. The second thing that occurred to me is this whole notion of taking over the District of Columbia. There's an interesting history behind all of this. When the District of Columbia, your birthplace, Joe, was first created in the late 1700s, land was taken from Maryland and Virginia
right,
to form the federal district. I think it was in the 1840s that the part of D.C. south of the Potomac River, Arlington, Alexandria, which were part of the original D.C., they were returned to the Commonwealth of Virginia. Congress governed D.C. directly until 1973. I remember this well. In the 60s, I was an undergrad at Georgetown, and there was a commissioner appointed by Congress running the place. This went on until 1973, when limited home rule was instituted. But even today, D.C. residents are not represented by voting members in the House or Senate. They can vote for the President of the United States. There are three electoral votes assigned to D.C., but self-rule itself is not absolute. One solution that I read about years ago is actually something that would put this to rest forever, is to follow the 19th century precedent by reducing the size of the federal district, perhaps, to the Mall from the Lincoln Memorial to Congress, including the White House and Supreme Court buildings, and return the rest, along with nearly the entire population, to the state of Maryland, where people will have full voting rights and full self-government.
And it just seems like, you know, there were talks of statehood, there were talks of, we've had that for a long time. To Sarah's point, too, of just how this random incident then escalates to the point of we're going to take over the city of federal control. It seems like a lot has to happen prior to that.
Yeah, I don't think it's as simple as, for example, the president signing an executive order saying, I hereby appoint so-and-so as commissioner who will run run the District of Columbia in my name.
With that, we will call it a morning for the panel. My thanks to everyone, Bob Griffin, Fred Hoff, and Sarah Rogerson. You're all wonderful. Thank you for a really great discussion. I appreciate it very much. We'll be back right after this.